the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. Tomorrow is the 60th anniversary of the U.S. dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima, the first of only two times that the nuclear bomb has been used in warfare. Of course, it was Hiroshima on August 6th, and then on August 9th, just 3 days later, it was Nagasaki. And the reverberations, morally and in terms of the burden of history, continue. And, of course, you had Time Magazine's cover story last week. You're going to find a flurry of news articles and television media portrayals. History Channel, Discovery Channel, CNN, Fox News. You can depend that there's going to be a real diversity of approaches on this. There are two main camps when it comes down to looking back at the American use of the atomic bomb. Well, it comes down to this. One side says it's right. The other side says it's wrong. We're going to talk about the background of this. I published a major commentary on the question today and then a major weblog entry just this afternoon, but we want to hear what you have to say. The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. And after a review of issues in the news, we'll get to the discussion on Hiroshima 60 years later. Just this week, we were talking about the announcement from Korean scientists of the successful cloning of a dog. And we also talked about the fact that the dog's uniquely complicated reproductive system means that this is, if true, and it is apparently true, a signal scientific development. But is this good news or bad news? Of course, this gets right to the heart of the debate over cloning and all the rest. And the cloning of a dog, we're told, is actually more scientifically complex, genetically speaking, and in terms of reproductive biology, than cloning a human being. Now, this particular laboratory, led by Dr. Hwang in Korea, has also been in the news because this is the laboratory that's been really kind of pushing the envelope on the cloning of human embryos for stem cell research. So you put all this together, and this appears to be an ominous development. Now, yesterday I talked about Nigel Cameron, the bioethicist, who says that cloning dogs is really kind of a run-up to cloning human beings. But what I find interesting today is how the editorial pages of some of our newspapers are responding to the same news. The New York Times published a major editorial today in which it went on and said the larger lesson here is that the Koreans are truly a force to be reckoned with in cloning and stem cell research. This team was the first to clone human embryos and extract stem cells from them, and now it is the first to clone a dog, perhaps the most difficult feat in mammalian cloning. The center of gravity in cloning and stem cell research may be shifting abroad while American efforts are slowed by taboos and financing restrictions. Well, let's just get to the bottom line of what this editorial is all about. It asserts that we should be embarrassed that it was Korean scientists rather than American scientists who cloned this dog. Furthermore, the paper, the New York Times, no insignificant newspaper here, argues that America is falling behind in cloning research and in embryo research because of, well, let's just use their words, taboos and financing restrictions. Taboos. Now, you know, that suggests that there's nothing more than a cultural opposition. That's what the word taboo really comes down to. Sociologists and anthropologists use that word to talk about something that's culturally rejected. Is that all there is here? And when it comes to the issue of cloning, much less cloning a dog, let's talk about cloning a human being. Is that merely a taboo? This is the same laboratory that is pushing the envelope in cloning human embryos. I find this a truly ominous development not only in Korea, but in the pages of the New York Times. And as you know, this show is broadcast live nationwide from Louisville, Kentucky. Right here, our own hometown newspaper, the Courier-Journal, predictably on the left, says this. It celebrates the first canine clone. And it says some states are trying to forge ahead alone, but this nation's entire scientific enterprise needs to be fully engaged in order to fathom, develop, and prepare for the extraordinary powers that are nearly at hand. Snuppy, that's the name of this clone dog, is barking while America is still chasing its tail. In their editorial, the Courier-Journal also said this, in truth, America needs to do far more than just loosen those bonds, talking about the Stem Cell Research Enhancement Act of 2005 that's now much debated. Embryonic science, they say, is speeding ahead elsewhere, and other nations are much further along in establishing ground rules, procedures, and oversight to ensure that the research is conducted responsibly and ethically, end quote. Now, let me just make something very clear. You see, it's one thing to argue that this research is itself a matter of ethical concern, and it's something else to just leapfrog right over that question and suggest that this research is going to be done, so it needs to be done within the right ethical boundaries and the right ethical guidelines. Do you understand what's going on here? You leap over the more important question of whether it should be done in the first place. You leap over the great moral question about the basic moral status of human cloning, or of animal cloning, or of cloning research, or of a human embryo, and then you just get to, let's do it right. That's sort of like replacing etiquette for ethics. That's like suggesting that on the other side of moral disaster, you can put together guidelines to try to limit the disaster. Let me push this argument just a little bit further. Those guidelines are made by whom, and how long will they last? You'll notice that we're continuing to negotiate away the basic understanding of human dignity and human life as these technologies and as further developments continue to push the questions. We're going to have to watch this very closely, but there's obviously more behind the news of this cloned dog than what has to do with canines. This is ultimately about us. It's ultimately about human cloning, and it's ultimately about what will be coming next as the logic behind this technology is pressed even further. While we're speaking of human embryonic stem cell research, of course, it's back in the news again. Charles Krauthammer, very prominent columnist who is often very clear-headed, often very insightful. He's an attorney and a medical doctor. He's a man of vast experience, but he also buys into this worldview that it is all right, it is morally fine, permissible, to use human embryos that would otherwise be discarded from medical research. Now, he says we ought to move ahead with embryonic stem cell research, but he basically agrees with Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist in terms of his recent turnaround that we should extend federal funding to research on human embryos that will destroy only embryos that will be discarded. These are embryos, by and large, that were created in in vitro fertilization clinics and are not going to be implanted in a mother's womb. The line he suggests we should draw is between discarded embryos, or embryos that would be discarded, and embryos that would be created just for the purposes of human embryonic stem cell research. Now, let me show you why that line won't work. Number one, it begs the question of the moral status of the embryo in the first place. You know, the question of why the embryo was created is a much less significant question than what is the embryo right now. That's the question Dr. Krauthammer's position just avoids, along with Senator Frist. The other problem with that is this. Those who are really pushing for the radical expansion of human embryonic stem cell research aren't satisfied to work with the embryos that would be discarded from IVF clinics. They are demanding the right to clone human embryos so that these embryos would be most useful for them in their research. Now, the New Republic, that is a fascinating news magazine of the left. It is often one of the most intelligent magazines you find on the liberal side of the media. They write this, responding to Senator Frist's turnaround on the stem cell question. They say, a flat worlder contending that the world is round. The effect was exhilarating. For a few summer months, and then for the duration of this difficult and momentous debate, the leader of the Republican majority surrendered his superstition and joined the reality-based community. Now, folks, that statement is just dripping with condescension, but it really tells you what the cultural elite is thinking when they look at those who, on moral and theological grounds, on worldview grounds, are opposed to human embryonic research. Now, they go on and they say this, as they're talking about Senator Frist, that they demand greater tolerance from Americans. Then they go on and they say that when you look at the whole issue of stem cell research, they say we must not pander to unreason. So in other words, it's a question in their minds of rationality. All rational people would come to their conclusions. If you hold to the special status of the human embryo as marked by human dignity and deserving a protection because of the sacredness of human life, you are being, by, well, the logical inference of their own reason, irrational. The only explanation they can come up with is that we must be superstitious. Well, we're right back to the New York Times, aren't we? Here at the end of the week, we find out from the New Republic and the New York Times that opposition to this kind of biotechnology is rooted either in taboo or superstition. Well, folks, what about being rooted in the very assumption about human life that marked human civilization, especially in the West, and especially in America, until just recently. We're not the ones who've moved, folks. It's those who have this new, very manipulative, very insufficient view of human life and human dignity that now consider themselves reasonable and would call us irrational. The burden of history is always on us. We're going to look back today 60 years to the dropping of the bomb on Hiroshima. That anniversary comes tomorrow, but the discussion comes today on the Albert Mueller Program. I want to know what you think. The phone number, 877-893-8255. 877-893-TALK. I'm Albert Mueller. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. I got to tell you a little background on today's conversation. I really did my graduate work during the 1980s, and I can tell you that during that period, the dominant academic model, the cultural elite, certainly the intellectual elites in America and in Western Europe, were absolutely committed to the fact that the nuclear bomb, the atomic bomb, the hydrogen bomb, but let's just talk about Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The atomic bomb was one of the worst things ever to happen to humanity. And the American use of the bomb was absolutely immoral, and that it didn't have anything to do with the end of the war anyway, because the Japanese were already trying to surrender. But the Americans just wouldn't let them surrender, but went ahead and used the bomb. Now, what's behind that is a great conflict among historians, and it's a very instructive conflict. And on the one hand are those who hold to what you could call the traditional view of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the traditional view of how World War II ended in terms of the Pacific theater. That view holds this, that the Japanese people, and beyond that, the Japanese leaders in the War Council, were absolutely determined that they would not accept unconditional surrender. They were absolutely determined to protect the home islands of Japan, and they were absolutely determined to fight to the death if necessary. They were absolutely determined to protect the emperor and the imperial system, and to protect also the continuation of the Japanese military. And thus, what the Americans learn, according to the traditionalist interpretation on Okinawa and Iwo Jima and throughout the Pacific War, is that this is a people driven by a warrior ethos of Bushido who simply will not surrender and will fight to the death. And thus, the traditional view holds that President Truman decided to use the atomic bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki because the Japanese people had to be brought to the point where they would surrender. The Japanese War Council had to be brought to a moment of desperation where they would surrender. And the argument is that the atomic bombs basically were instrumental in ending the Pacific War, enforcing the Japanese surrender, and also in saving many, many lives, certainly what were estimated to be something like 700,000 American lives that would have been lost in an invasion of the Japanese islands, and untold lives of Japanese civilians as well. That's the traditional view. And to be honest, that's the view that I picked up in school, in history class. That's the view I picked up just in terms of the American mind growing up as a child of the Cold War. But another view began to develop. You won't be surprised about this. A revisionist understanding of history, and those who hold to this position say, look, Japan was already a defeated foe. It was already basically running out of options. The Japanese people were trying to find a way to avoid an invasion, and the Japanese War Council was trying to find a way to surrender. They argue that America really didn't use the atomic bomb so much to end the war in Japan by forcing a Japanese surrender, as America used the atomic bomb in order to prevent the Soviets from gaining a toehold in Asia by entering the war, and thus the atomic bomb ended the Soviet myth that they could conquer a lot of Pacific territory, brought the world to the World War II to a conclusion, such that America could dictate terms, Douglas MacArthur could be the supreme commander, and could rearrange the entire Pacific according to American interests. Now, let me tell you the problems with the revisionist view, and I want to speak honestly about this. We're going to talk about the morality of nuclear weapons. We're going to talk about the morality of President Truman's decision to drop the bomb. But we need to talk honestly about what we now know about the end of the war. And we know a lot that we did not know before, and that is because in the last 10 years, tomorrow's the 60th anniversary, but on the 50th anniversary, we experienced the declassification of an awful lot of military intelligence that was what was driving the American perception about the realities at the end of the war. And here's what we now know. Because the Americans were decoding the Japanese messages to and from all their cables and the rest, the American leadership, President Truman and his advisors, knew that the Japanese war cabinet was not at the point of surrender, that they had rejected what was a demand for unconditional surrender that the Allies issued at the Potsdam Conference, and that instead Japan was trying to gain the assistance of the Soviet Union in negotiating something short of an unconditional surrender. And thus, and now remember, when you talk about the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, you're talking about just untold, almost incalculable devastation. You're talking about 150,000 deaths with the two cities put together, some immediate, perhaps 125,000 immediately, and then at least 25,000 and maybe more after that in terms of later deaths from radiation sickness. But remember that there had already been hundreds of thousands of Japanese who had died in bombings that weren't atomic, but were related to fire bombings of Japanese cities. You know, this is a horrible reality, but on this program at least, let's try to talk about reality. And rather than the world as we might wish it had been in 1945, we have to talk about the world as it was. We have to put ourselves in the position of President Harry Truman. And let me just throw a couple things out here. I believe that a decision to build the bomb was a decision to use the bomb. I think America was at the point where the American people would not have tolerated a president who declined to use a weapon that would have brought the war to a conclusion. I also want to say right up front that by the emperor's own words, Emperor Hirohito before the War Council, by his own words, the atomic bombs in terms of Hiroshima and Nagasaki did have an impact. They were a part in the Japanese decision to surrender because the Japanese decision to surrender eventually came down to Hirohito himself, who in a very solemn series of words before the War Council simply said, we must bear this shame and humiliation and accept this surrender. And he mentioned in particular the bombs. Now, did the Soviet Union's entry into the war on August 8th, the night before Nagasaki, have an impact? You bet it did. It ended the Japanese hope that there could be a third party to help them to negotiate something short of an unconditional surrender. And it also ended the illusion that the Soviets could be kept out of the Pacific Basin. It gave the Americans even more incentive to bring this war to a conclusion. You know, all this is retrospect, isn't it? We're looking back 60 years. We're trying to make sense of one of the great moral issues of our time. But, you know, this has immediate relevance to where we live today. Whether it's the war on terror or larger questions of national security or its current debates over nuclear weapons and test ban treaties and nuclear proliferation and all the rest, we're still living with the legacy of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We're still living with the enduring moral questions, and we're still living with the burden of history. Now, folks, in my commentary published this morning and in an extensive weblog entry published this afternoon in which I respond to some of the press treatments today, I really have to mix the personal and the theoretical, moral analysis and personal reflections. And a lot of my thinking on this is shaped by the fact that I have talked with some of those men who were serving in the Pacific, and I know how they understood the end of the war and what they knew that it meant. I have to think of my friend Joe Reynolds, a Marine officer. He's now living in Houston, Texas. He's a dear friend. He was a Marine officer on Iwo Jima. He's one of those who went in with many, many friends and fellow colleagues and left with very few. What he and others like him understood at the end of the war was that the Japanese surrender after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, it meant that they would live. Paul Fussell, a very famous writer, whose subsequent writings really helped to frame our understanding of the World War in both theaters, especially in Europe. He was a young officer leading troops in France. Now, the war was over there, and they were getting ready to be shipped out to the Pacific Theater to invade Japan. When they heard that the Japanese had surrendered after the two atomic bombs, Paul Fussell said this meant that we would grow up. We would reach adulthood after all. I can't think of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I can't think of this whole question without thinking of men like that and knowing that their lives really mattered too. I want to know what you think. The phone number, 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. Was America right to use the atomic bomb? Were we wrong? What would you say to President Truman if you were his advisor? And what would you say now in terms of American policy? 877-893-8255, Hiroshima and the Burden of History. We'll be right back with your conversation. This is the Albert Mohler Program.
listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. You know, one of the realities we face is that the 20th century, now the 21st century, brings some big questions to the Christian tradition of thinking about war. And let me just mention this. The central Christian tradition in thinking about war, this isn't a hypothetical issue. We have to decide whether we're going to fight or not. We have to decide whether Christians can be in the Army, the Air Force, the Navy, the Marines, or not. We have to decide what Christian morality would demand of us. And the central Christian tradition has been summarized in what is known as just war theory. And one of the principles of just war theory that's very important is that non-combatants are not to be targeted. Now, World War II already brought that question into very stark relief. You had the Allied bombing of Dresden in the European theater. You had the bombing of Hamburg and later the attacks upon Berlin and other cities. And it's true that even though there were industrial targets, we all knew, and I wasn't alive then, but Americans all knew, the Allied leaders all knew, that there would be civilians among the casualties as well. Then, of course, when you deal with atomic bombs, you're talking about the devastation that is so widespread over an entire city or region that there's no way that that non-combatants or civilians aren't targeted in some way. The reality is that as much as that Christian tradition of just war theory rightly privileges non-combatants, we're now living in a world in which it's not just bullets and spears and arrows that can be targeted at individuals. These big-scale mega-weapons, what do we call them now? Weapons of mass destruction? They really aren't very well targeted, and certainly an atomic bomb isn't very well targeted, only at military targets. And so that's a part of the background here. You know, there are those who say then that we can't use them. Well, what if the enemy uses them? In other words, we're living in a real world with real decisions. President Harry Truman in August of 1945 had to make a decision. And in many ways, it was a decision that was already made before he even came into the presidency with the death of Franklin Roosevelt. To make the bomb was really politically a decision to use the bomb, because I don't think any president could have responsibly not used it, knowing that it could bring the war to a conclusion. But I want to know what you think. Let's go back 60 years. Let's ask the question, and then let's look at what history has taught us since then. The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. I want to hear what you have to think. Let's go to Sean calling from Bakersfield, California. Welcome, Sean. All right, looks like we lost Sean there. I want to know what you think about this. The phone number again, 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. Well, the newspapers are talking about it, and so also are some of the commentators on television. That's why I published a weblog again later this afternoon, because I really think that this is an issue that is likely to come more to public attention over the next 24 hours or so with the anniversary tomorrow. Let me tell you, the New York Times has made references to it, but the Los Angeles Times released a major editorial today. It's by Kai Bird and Martin Sherwin. They're the co-authors of a recent book, American Prometheus, The Triumph and Tragedy of Robert Oppenheimer. And I want you to hear one of the statements they make in this editorial. They say, "The bomb was dropped, as J. Robert Oppenheimer, scientific director of the Manhattan Project, said in November 1945, on an essentially defeated enemy. President Truman and his closest advisor, Secretary of State James Burns, quite plainly used it primarily to prevent the Soviets from sharing in the occupation of Japan. And they used it on August 6th, even though they had agreed among themselves as they returned home from the Potsdam Conference on August 3rd that the Japanese were looking for peace." Now, here's one of the real difficulties. What does looking for peace mean? Japan, well, maybe it's fair to say they were looking for peace, but they were looking for peace on their terms. They were not looking to surrender their military ambitions. They were not willing to accept anything like the unconditional surrender that the Allies demanded at the Potsdam Conference. Let's remember the realities of the Pacific War. Let's remember what was happening in terms of the Japanese warrior ethos of Bushido. And let's put ourselves back as much as we can into the reality that we now know what was going on in the deliberations before the Japanese War Council. We know they were greatly divided on whether to surrender and how. And we know that they made the unconditional requirement that the imperial system would continue. We also know that even after Emperor Hirohito, in August of 1945, declared the necessity of surrender, there was an attempted military coup that was actually successful in seizing control of the imperial palace. This was not a united nation. This is not a united war council and questions of surrender. We now have information that even President Truman didn't have, and we know a lot about what he knew. Was his decision right or wrong? How do we live with the burden of this historical question? The phone number 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. The question of Hiroshima is not going to go away. These anniversaries come with the moral obligation that we as Christians think through the question once again, because we may face this issue once again, and someone may face this decision once again. I'm Albert Moeller. Thesis about today's program. I think it's taken a while for some listeners to try to figure out what they would want to say here. I think the gravity of this question really demands that we think, and think deeply and think carefully. And the phone lines are lighting up. There's still time for you to call 877-893-8255. We have Jeff on the line from Clearwater, Florida, listening on WTBN. Jeff, go right ahead.
Hi, Dr. Moeller. It's good to talk to you. I think that it's kind of an oversimplification of the whole thing to rule out the political aspect. And I'm not saying I'm against the use of, I think it was a prudent choice at the time to use the nuclear weapons. I mean, LeMay's firebombings of Tokyo were killing more people than the bombs were. But I think that most of 1945, if not a little bit of 1944, was about the world after the war. We were shaping that because Japanese was a defeated country, and an invasion probably could have been prevented through firebombings if we would have waited. So,
Jeff, you know, that's real interesting, because what you're suggesting is a true minority position. I mean, just take the experience of Okinawa and Iwo Jima. Take the fact that the Japanese were arming civilians, including children and little old ladies, with sharpened bamboo spears to use in an invasion, and also take the fact that the head of the army was committed to what he called a national Harry Carey, a national suicide, if possible, to preserve the integrity of the character of Japan. I would agree that there were considerations that were important in terms of the post-war period, but those really had to come after the island-hopping campaign began and after the realities of Okinawa and Iwo Jima. And, you know, I think no one should diminish or minimize the political considerations. War is a political act. But at the same time, you're talking about a nation that had shown anything. You say it's a defeated foe. And, you know, I'll tell you, the problem with that is you can make an economic calculation. There was no way Japan could defeat the United States. You can make all kinds of calculations. But they weren't acting like a defeated foe, and they were committed to a worldview that really did not allow them to do so. And it's fascinating. I would suggest to everyone that one of the best resources to read here is just out, a very important new book published by Harvard University Press. It's entitled Racing the Enemy. It's by Toyoishi Hasegawa, who's a Japanese historian who teaches now at the University of California at Santa Barbara. It makes extensive use of declassified sources, and I think it's an intellectually honest book. Even where I disagree with it, I think it's intellectually honest. And at the end of the book, he goes through a series of scenarios asking, would Japan have surrendered if, and you know, comes to the conclusion that it was a combination of the atomic bombs and the Soviet entry into the war that was decisive in those first days of August. Jeff, we appreciate your call. Yes, we need to avoid oversimplification. That's one of the reasons why we need to have this conversation. It's very hard to go back and imagine being Harry Truman having to make this decision. Let's go to Derek calling from Fort Knox, Kentucky, listening on WFIA. Derek, welcome to the program.
Hi, glad to be here. One of the things I think, you know, people tend to forget is, and I am calling as a soldier, I have been to Iraq. You know, I mourn the death of any civilian in a combat situation, but something people tend to forget that when you have war, people are going to die, be they civilians or soldiers. And in the situation of a world war like we had then, You got to figure that the people that start the war, you know, they're probably looking for world domination. I mean, that's kind of the point of why, you know, it's kind of how it all ends up in the end. And you kind of got to see that, you know.
Well, Derek, let me interrupt you for a minute. Let me ask you a question. And I appreciate the fact that you've got a unique credibility calling as a veteran and as a person in uniform. And let me ask you this. Certainly, it is the policy of the United States military, whenever possible, to avoid killing civilians. I mean, even in Iraq and in the Gulf War, that's the point of a lot of these precision munitions and precision laser-guided bombs and all the rest. Yes, it's absolutely true there can be no war in which some civilians aren't killed, but I mean, you do agree that, at least in theory, as a matter of moral commitment, you would want to avoid killing civilians where possible, right?
Oh, definitely. You know, everything in our rules of engagement, even, you know, in situations where it was us and the only other people around were the enemy, it was still look and know what you're doing before you shoot.
You know, Derek, you're reminding me of something. You remember in both of the Gulf Wars, but especially in the most recent war in Iraq, it was known that the Americans were preparing for war and all this, Saddam Hussein tended to move military installations right into civilian populations, didn't he? I mean, that was kind of a way of just making it more costly. Now, the morality there is then on Saddam Hussein. I mean, he's the one who took the immoral act. He's the one who made it impossible for many of these military targets to be reached, justifiable targets, without also having some civilian casualties. And I appreciate your call, Derek. God bless you as you serve in the nation's uniform. Let's go to Fernando, calling from Dallas, Texas, listening on XM Satellite Radio. Fernando, it's your turn.
Yeah, thank you for having me on. I just wanted to mention that I think at that time, I wasn't born at that time, but because of the loss of life and all the situations with Russia, Russia flexing its muscle, and also the economy of the United States. And the economy of the United States at that time was they were really using up a lot of resources and really suffering through it. And I think it was one of those things that they had to do at the time. And also, I'm glad it's something that I should ponder in the future, because of the way the world is right now, anything can happen. And,
yeah, that's true, Jim. You know, I think the scariest thing about all this is to imagine what would be different, Fernando, excuse me, if, for instance, a terrorist had a bomb like this. What would happen if Al-Qaeda gained possession of a nuclear bomb? They would not be constrained by the kind of moral concerns that we're talking about here, because their entire goal is to create as much devastation as possible. You know, in one of the editorials that was published just in today's newspapers, and in particular, this was published in today's Wall Street Journal, it said this, and I think this is exactly right. The Wall Street Journal said, looking back after 60 years, who cannot be grateful that it was Truman who had the bomb and not Hitler or Tojo or Stalin? And looking forward, who can seriously doubt the need for might always to remain in the hands of right? That, they argue, is the enduring lesson of Hiroshima, and it's one we ignore at our peril. Well, that raises the question of nuclear proliferation. You know, it's a miracle of sorts, isn't it, that 60 years after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, no nuclear weapon has been detonated in hostility? The United States and the Soviet Union had thousands of stockpiled nuclear weapons, thousands aimed at each other. The doctrine of mutual assured destruction is what framed the military doctrine of the Cold War. All we know is, at this point, atomic war, nuclear war didn't happen, and that's a good thing. I'll be right back with some final thoughts. I'm Albert Bowler. Welcome back, folks. You know, history is not only looking backwards, it's moving forwards. And that's the reason why we need to have a very cogent, clear, and thoughtful understanding of the decisions made in the past in order to help frame the decisions we ought to make in the future. And there is no question that the two world wars were in many ways the defining events of the 20th century. And to understand our own times, we have to understand what these events really meant. And in the case of the end of the Second World War in the Pacific, we have to understand what was at stake and how leaders made decisions, and we need to do everything we can as those who follow the Prince of Peace to set the stage so that we would not find ourselves, not only as a nation, but as a world, in such a situation again. you know, once war begins, given the sinfulness of human nature, awful things are going to happen. Awful things are going to happen. And that's why we need to have a moral framework, even in the midst of the horror of war, to make sure that we do our very best to mitigate the kind of carnage and damage and casualties that inevitably come in military conflict. The development of the nuclear bomb, of the atomic bomb as it was then known, is an amazing part of the 20th century. The roots of it go back before World War II, when scientists really began to solve the theoretical basis for what became the atomic bomb. We need to remember that there was a race even during that time, during the war, to see which nation would first develop the bomb. It could have been Nazi Germany. As a matter of fact, most of the scientists who really made such a big difference in the theoretical basis were German scientists. Many of them, because they were Jewish, were simply expelled from Germany before the war started. Hitler, driven by his anti-Semitic hate, actually, in many ways, prevented Germany from being the first to develop the atomic bomb. I'm thankful for that. I think we need to be bold enough to make clear moral judgments to say it is a good thing. It isn't indeed a wonderful thing that Hitler was not the one who first had the atomic bomb. If so, World War II would surely have ended differently, and the world as we know it would be very different from what it is today. I'm thankful that the Soviet Union was not the first to have the bomb, given its territorial ambitions in World War II. And I'm thankful that Imperial Japan did not have the bomb. The morality of using a weapon as destructive and awful as an atomic bomb weighs heavily on the human conscience, and it must always do so. The 60th anniversary of this bombing is a good opportunity for us to go back and think these questions anew. I can promise you this, the conversation is going to continue, not only in the media over the next several days, but among historians and others looking forward. We're living in history, embedded in our own times, looking at the past and looking to the future. I'll be back next week for Intelligent Christian Conversation with you on the Albert Mueller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.